You're listening to Star Wars Beyond the Films, the official expanded universe podcast of StarWarsReport.com.
There is a great disturbance in the Force.
Welcome to Star Wars Beyond the Films feedback episode for April 2012. This is your Star Wars discussion podcast, and this episode, you're the star. I'm one of your hosts, the defender of the EU, Mark Hertleman, and with me, like a bad case of Aboleth possession still, because you know, you just can't get rid of him, the EU guru himself, Nathan P. Butler.
Hello, hello everyone. We'll be talking a lot about Aboleth coming up in a future episode about Fate of the Jedi to determine whether or not Aboleth possession is actually a good thing or a bad one. I'll give you a hint right now, not a good thing. Did that give it away?
Watch those tentacles! Watch those tentacles now!
You worry about those tentacles, I'll worry about the... I don't know, just name another body part. No, I'm sorry, that just came out way too dirty. Not really meant that way!
Nice. Now, you know, we've had one of these feedback episodes. We now have a second one ready to go. As long as you keep sending us the feedback on Facebook, email, and all so forth, we'll keep putting them out there. Our first email is from Eric D., and this was sent back in January. He writes, "The Phantom Menace premiered in 1999, and Attack of the Clones in 2002. Since the New Jedi Order was written between 2000 and 2004, what influence, if any, did the prequel trilogy have on the New Jedi Order? Clearly, the New Jedi Order has deep ties to the EU, and the expanded universe before the prequel trilogy definitely had its own ideas about the pre-A New Hope era. I also understand that the New Jedi Order was an entirely pre-planned series, but I can't help but wonder if any prequel concepts crept into the books on the way. Otherwise, when did the events of the prequels finally find their way into post-Return of the Jedi Expanded Universe books? From what I've heard, there was a point in Legacy of the Force when recordings from the prequel era are found in R2-D2. Eric, you're referencing Darkness when that occurred. Now, you know, your first question... The New Jedi Order come out around the same time that the prequels. Was there an influence on the New Jedi Order? Nathan, I don't know about you, but I want to say there was very little influence.
Yeah, there really wasn't a whole heck of a lot. I mean, it was darker, but they were already sort of going that direction thanks to where New Jedi Order in and of itself was already going. So it's more like, what they call it, parallel evolution in a sense here, where you've got one that's becoming darker while the other one is at the same time. And, oh, hey! Happy coincidence, they're both going in that darker direction. That was actually a point of a lot of criticism back then about how Star Wars was getting significantly darker. I would say, though, that probably the thing that stands out to me as the two closest ties, I guess, between New Jedi Order and the prequel era are relatively light ties. One is that we got some backstory on Zenoma Sikot, the planet, and that backstory, of course, was initially portrayed in the novel Rogue Planet, which was designed as a prequel-era tie-in novel, so not necessarily a tie-in to the films themselves, but to Obi-Wan and Anakin during the gap between Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones. So at least there was that level of connection. A much more specific and obvious connection rather than what we see in Apocalypse that we'll talk about oh, by the way, didn't you know that Yoda told me about something? I never mentioned that before. The other thing, though, is the title of the final book, because the unifying force was, in a sense, as opposed to the living force, which is a concept of sort of those two elements within force philosophy that was being pushed once we got that phrase, you know, be mindful of the living force in The Phantom Menace. So it's small ties. I mean, there were some, but it certainly didn't feel like it was something where I would almost say you wouldn't even have to even have watched the prequels to be able to understand what was going on in New Jedi Order. The ties were very, very tenuous.
Yeah, it was definitely the stage for the big three, you know, and that's when we actually got the big three. Before that, it was the big four, or five, I guess, if you're going to count Lando, but Lando never really gets the count love. Yeah, I almost completely forgot about Rogue Planet. It was one of those that, you know, a lot of people say it was like the first New Jedi Order book in the sense of the timeline because, you know, it came first and it set up a lot of things that would later become issues. I believe Outbound Flight did something similar with the Yuuzhan Vong as far outsiders. But yeah, as far as the movies go, I don't see very much, if any, influence at the time. That's one of those things where George was very tight-lipped, I think. I don't think he was sharing anything really with what was going on in the planning room. You know, we know that his making the decision that Chewie was the one that was going to pass away in Vector Prime, that was like the main influence that we had from George. I don't think he was giving many other ideas at that time. Now, the other side of this is, when did the events of the prequels finally find their way into a post-Return of the Jedi Expanded Universe books? And you had mentioned, Eric, about R2-D2 having the recordings. He had recordings of Order 66 he had patched into the Jedi Temple. And we see this, I believe, in the third or second book of the Darkness series. And Jason was kind of, you know, he was right there with Luke, and there was all this foreshadowing of what's going to later happen with Jason's character, too. But, you know, there's a couple references we get. It's tricky because of the dating. I mean, I try to look at Star Wars as a timeline, but the reality is that our world publishes these books at random times, and they slip in like, oh, it was always there, but it really wasn't. And so, you know, you ask a very difficult question, but luckily for you, good sir, we have Nathan Butler here.
You know, what stands out to me about, you know, the point where they finally start to link together these it shows not only stuff from around the era of Order 66, but of course we get to see more information about, Anakin and Padme and their relationship and whatnot, thanks to those records stored within R2-D2. And the whole premise was that, well, it's hidden memories in a sense, because without being able to repair that part of R2-D2's memory, those memories are inaccessible. In fact, they're even causing problems until being accessed. So it allowed for us to have at least somewhat of a logical reason for why all of a sudden, after, you know, decades, now Luke and Leia finally get to find out something, you know? There are plenty of plot holes there within that whole idea. You know, of all the different records that existed still within the Empire and from before that when it was the Republic, there's not a lot of previous information about Anakin, about Padme. I mean, certainly at least a little bit about Anakin, but about Padme, about the background there. The easy reason, of course, is, well, you know, Lucas hadn't finished making the prequels, and that kind of stuff was pretty much off limits. Instead, what we wind up with is kind of this odd way of trying to shoehorn it in, giving us some sort of continuity way for why it would take so long, and it winds up giving us one of what I think is one of the few redeeming qualities of the Darkness trilogy. I mean, I think of those books, and what pops to mind are two things. One, bugs! And how Han just hates bugs, apparently. Especially giant sentient ones, and the scenes with R2-D2. Like, literally, if I close my eyes and try to picture Dark Nest, and I'm not seeing one of the cover images, I'm seeing this image in my mind of R2-D2 providing the information about their parents to Luke and Leia. You know, that is what screams in my mind from that series of books. And for that to have only been a few scenes, and that's what I remember from Dark Nest, kind of goes towards why we tend to mock Dark Nest from time to time, because it's just really... It was an odd series that had that memorable moment, but not much else memorable, in my opinion.
Well, when you have flow walking that you get in the first book, and by the third book, it's been completely retconned within its own series. You're like, wait, what? But you're right, though. That was one of the more powerful scenes in that series, and that is probably my favorite scene of that book series. When I was reading it, I was watching, you know, episode three, watching that scene again, and it just, it brings you there. I mean, it did a really good job of R2 not only just jacked into the temple. I mean, he literally recorded every single camera that was going down, because when Anakin left and took him over to the temple, he had a feeling something was wrong, and Anakin shut him out. And so R2's inquisitive nature was like, I better see what's going down, because something's going down. And oh, man, it was just one of those moments. And I believe when it was portrayed, Leia wasn't there. It was just Luke and Jason. And Jason's coming across like he's just trying to get Luke to just, you know, do the choose and act and not worry about the dark side or the consequences. And he's like trying to use it as like an example of why he should. And you're just like, Jason, this ain't really working there, buddy.
I just hope, I mean, I know that there was a point at which we saw the death of Padme within the recordings. Like, it's something they knew, not only this really is their mother, who they had apparently supposedly and just never said it out loud, because of course it wasn't something that was known within Star Wars yet, that hey, this is his and her mother. So now we're finally putting the pieces together from suspicion to actual proof. But we also find out, or at least they find out, we already knew, find out how she dies. And I just wish that at some point there had been a moment where Luke or Leia sat back and just kind of turned to us as sort of breaking the fourth wall and said, "Lost the will to live? What the hell is that?"
That would be epic. Oh my gosh.
It's okay. You just had two healthy baby children. Don't worry. It's okay to lose the will to live now, because obviously children are not enough to live for if you don't have your Sith Lord, you know, man toy.
They're in Obi-Wan's hands. They'll be okay. Look how well Anakin turned out.
Yeah, exactly.
Another EU work that also addresses this issue was Tatooine Ghost. I mean, that, I believe, was the first time that Leia kind of really gets a sense of who her mom, not her mom, but her grandmother is. She ends up finding Shmi Skywalker's journal. It was left behind when she was attacked by the sand people at one of the moisture evaporators, and I believe the Darklighter family ends up buying Luke's old property, or Owen and Beru's property, and they give it to her then, and she's able to get some understanding and some insight into her father's life and stuff as a young child as well. And that was another one of those works that, you know, Denning had some things going. I mean, Denning seems to be one of the authors that, right off the top of my head, that really kind of went out of his way to tie things together. And as we'll talk in Apocalypse, that doesn't always work out, but it definitely, you know, he's got the heart in the right area, I guess, and when it comes to trying to keep things cohesive.
Yeah, they build these in a sense as the couple novels at times. There's the Luke and Mara novel, Survivor's Quest, don't get me started, and then you've got Tatooine Ghost as the Han and Leia novel of the time, being pushed out by Del Rey. And Denning, I mean, he did a good job, I guess. He managed to pull in a lot of these prequel characters and give us an organic way for Leia to learn more about Anakin's background as a slave and everything else. But, of course, it was another one of these things that was in a written in a time period where there were certain things that weren't going to be allowed to be talked about. There's only so far that they could go. So, you know, how deep could that story have been? And, of course, it's taking place in a time period where we've already seen stories set afterwards where they didn't know very much about what happened with their parents. So how much could really be revealed? It was a very restrictive, I think, framework in which to work. And it suffers from what I think I'm officially going to start dubbing the buyer's market effect. You know, I mock the fact that Buyer's Market was written essentially to tell the story of how on earth did Lando get one of the AT-ATs that's underneath Nomad City on Naclan from the Thrawn trilogy. A question that nobody really had asked, it seemed like, over the years. And this kind of answered another of these, because we had already taken as a given for years that eventually Han and Leia have kids. We see in the Thrawn trilogy the birth of the twins, okay? So we know that at some point they have the kids. And we know that she has to come to terms with the background of Vader early on. In one of the early books, I want to say it was it Truset Bakura? I forget which one it was off the top of my head. Yeah, but she has that vision. It and it gives her a chance to sort of start to come to grips with how, you know, her father was Vader, what he did versus what he was within the context of her life and all this kind of stuff. So we'd already gotten enough to really sort of find it believable that, yeah, you know, she decided to have kids with Han. No big deal. And yet now we have an entire book, Tatooine Ghost, built around the idea of she's so wishy-washy, she doesn't know, should they have kids, should they not? If they have kids, will they turn out to be like Vader? Oh no, she's so confused. Don't worry, this brief encounter with Thrawn over a freaking painting and running into some of Anakin's childhood friends, that's going to clear up all those possible motherhood issues that she has. Thank goodness for Tatooine Ghost, because, yeah, we really needed that story.
Well, I think, though, that it did address that question, but you're right. I think not many people were wondering it. But there was a point, and I think it was Truset Bakura, where, you know, Anakin comes to her, and she pretty much rejects him flat out. I want nothing to be, you know, I don't want anything to do with you. And that's pretty much where she, you know, decides she didn't want to have kids. And so a lot of people were like, well, what made her change her mind? And I will give Denning, he did a good job using the prequel trilogy telling a tale as to why she would name her third son Anakin. I mean, it gives you the sense of, okay, she's at least healed enough to get over that hurdle. But you're right, though. I mean, it was one of those things where you're like, did it need to be, you know, brought up? I mean, I definitely think the EU as a whole kind of has a little more level to it and a little more filler, but I don't know if it was necessarily something that we needed to have. I mean, think about Dark Empire. I mean, you know, we got that comic, but if you're only reading books, you're just like, when did Luke turn to the dark side? And, you know, then you got to do the hunt to find it. It's one of those things, like, I would still love to see that kind of done in a novel form, you know? I mean, there are some gray areas out there that they could answer some questions that people aren't really worried about, but, you know, I still haven't given Buyer's Mark a chance yet because I'm just like, really? That's all that story's about?
Why, yes. Yes, it is. Now, I must say that, you know, it never would have occurred to me to ask the question, why did she change her mind about kids, or when did she decide to have kids? She just kind of did, because in real life, people don't always necessarily decide to have kids. It just sort of happens. I mean, I figured that at some point, Leia may have been wishy-washy, but one day, the medical droid held up the pregnancy test. It had a little plus in it, and all of a sudden she said, yeah, I guess I do want to have kids now, you know? It doesn't need a whole novel. And I'm not saying it's not necessarily an entertaining story, but I have a very hard time getting over the concept issue with some stories sometimes, to be able to just enjoy them as they are. I'm always thinking, why was this told? Why wasn't something else told? Why was this a full hardback at full hardback prices? Because I always try to approach it both from, you know, from a continuity standpoint, but also from a consumer standpoint, you know, because I buy all of these things. And that was always one that just kind of left me scratching my head. Not as much as Survivor's Quest after the fact, but, you know, at least it fits in that sort of that same category of meh to me.
Luke Skywalker in the shadows of meh. All right. Eric also sent in another email. This one was in April, I believe, about the time our 16th episode was released. Is that right, Nathan?
That's right. And in this one, Eric says, I don't know for sure if the Star Wars Expanded Universe will remain viable when there's no way to center stories around the main characters and situations from the movies, but I hope it does, and I definitely believe it should. I have nothing against tales of Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, and the rest after Return of the Jedi. I'm glad that the next few decades after the movies have been and are being thoroughly explored and fleshed out. But during that era, I'm already longing for stories about new, compelling characters independent from the established characters. When such a book does come along, I'm interested in it. The Expanded Universe has already shown its potential. The Force Unleashed proved that a new main cast of characters can be created that is just as interesting as the original heroes of the Rebellion. The Old Republic era has proved that totally new characters and situations can be created that are far removed from anything or anyone in the Republic / Empire era. I'd like to see something similar done in the far future beyond the Legacy era, with totally new characters and organizations, and this would ensure the longevity of new stories in the EU.
Nice. You know, you say some things there, Eric, that really strike me. You're absolutely right on the different eras and how they've worked. And you'd like to see something in the far future beyond the Legacy era. It's going to be a topic we're going to talk about in another episode. The whole era's issue. I have an issue with Legacy era specifically. I mean, we're talking about an era that, right after Darkness? Or was Darkness the first of that era? It was either that one or Legacy of the Force. One of those was the beginning of that era, and it goes all the way to Legacy Comics. It just bothers me that they do that. But I would love to see some stories set in this direction. And you're right. You know, they are going to have to center at some point more stories around characters that aren't the movie characters. I'm in the same boat as you. I think it's the best way to go down the road. I mean, if you don't, you know, Star Wars is doomed. You know, you got to have something new. Something. But the idea of new stuff in an era that's already being, you know, mined, you know, we mentioned, you know, is enough on certain areas. You know, they can't go to the bathroom anymore. And then we watch, you know, in Shadow Games, even though Han had a small role in it, you know, characters can hold their own. These new characters that come in, I would love to see more stories set in this time frame that kind of mirror stories I know that were in the movies and such. You know, like okay, A New Hope. We see the Outrider fly off. I mean, you know, it'd be cool to have like a Dash Rendar story where, you know, we find out why he was there and why he left, kind of thing. And something else of that nature. I mean, it doesn't have to have any of the main characters, but I think that there's enough people out there that a book like that would actually sell.
Yeah, and another thing that I think his email brings up, and something that I guess we didn't really deal with too much when we did the episode talking about this whole issue of the long-term viability and everything, is that with The Force Unleashed, it was a very unusual case. We said that usually when things are more viable as far as being outside the film characters, they tend to be ones in far-flung eras, like Tales of the Jedi, The Old Republic, Legacy, and such, where you sort of all have to learn the rules together, whether you're a longtime fan or not, or there are stories that tend to be based on video games, because video games have that mass market appeal. I think there's also another level beyond that, though, specifically with regard to The Force Unleashed. And that was a pretty, you know, it's a pretty controversial game at the time in and of itself. Some people loved it. There were a lot of people who disliked certain elements of that story, whether we're talking about, you know, when do they learn about the Death Star? Who is this Star Killer? Where does he come from? Where does he go? Where did you come from, Cotton Eye Joe? It's just a question of, I just jumped into my head. But the question of, you know, what happens to him? Why is he never mentioned ever in the future? I mean, there are issues that people have brought up, some of which are quite valid. But I will say, what made me really latch on to the Force Unleashed characters was less about the story in and of itself, but the story was compelling, but less about certain nuances of it, but how it was portrayed. And I literally mean portrayed in terms of music, special effect sounds, so, you know, explosions, lightsaber blades and stuff like that, and extremely well done voice acting. And the voice acting was paired with the character models. What I'm getting at here is that seeing the cutscenes and some of the levels of The Force Unleashed, you felt like you were essentially playing a Star Wars film. That gives you a much greater impact in a lot of cases for a lot of people, especially in this very multimedia heavy age, than, say, just reading a book. I'm not sure that I would have felt that the Force Unleashed characters were nearly as compelling if I hadn't seen the way that he was portrayed in the video game. Juno Eclipse, I don't think I would have found as compelling if not seeing how she was played in the video game. So a lot goes back to Sam Witwer and being able to perform very well as Starkiller. And, you know, you can't do that necessarily with every different era. I would love to see them do something, even if it's just as simple as that thing we mentioned a while back with that New Jedi Order commercial that had Mark Hamill coming back reprising the Luke role. You know, I had seen the worst of all wars and witnessed the redemption of evil, blah, blah, blah. Because it puts you in the heads of the characters and is like, hey, it's Luke. I don't know that there's an easy way to do that for something like Legacy or something like Tales of the Jedi, where you have a chance for people to get drawn into the characters in sort of a filmic sort of way or film analog, whether we're talking about the video games or whatever. When it's just in print, I think it's going to be a tougher sell. It's just not as likely to draw people in as much performance-wise, because it really isn't a performance other than what you imagine.
Well, and then I think about, like, the Imperial Commandos and Republic Commando books. You know, the video game Republic Commando came out before Karen Travis's Hard Contact. Hard Contact comes out, and it's not dealing with the clones that you played in the game, but a similar batch. I mean, and you have the same reaction. Like you said with The Force Unleashed 2, you have a lot of people that just absolutely love it, or a lot of people that just don't like it, and then you have those that fall in between. I mean, I guess you have that with everything, but it's interesting, though, that with these type of games, Force Unleashed 2 and the Commandos, that those that love it and hate it, boy, they really, I mean, commit to loving or hating it. And they will find their reasons to everything. But I think for me, with the Commando books, that was one of those things where, you know, the game was fun, but the books kind of set their own little universe, and it was set within what was going on. I'm trying to think, like, there weren't very many references to many Jedi that were in the movies, aside from, say, a quip about Yoda or Mace here or there. I mean, I don't know. It's one of those things where I really see a lot of potential here. I mean, I'm in the middle of Riptide right now, and I'm really enjoying it. And I'm finding myself going, you know, this is what they need to do is give us more characters like this and commit to them. And what I mean by commit to them is, okay, New Jedi Order, all right? New Jedi Order. New Jedi. New Jedi in the Order. And yet, who did we have? We had Luke. We had Mara. We have Leia. And yet, we've got these new heroes, Ganner Riso, Worth Skitter, Krill Waxarn, I believe is how you say it. You've got the Solos. And yet, by the end of the series, almost every one of these new Jedi are killed. You've got you've got Raynar Thul. You pretty much think he's dead. Just about anybody, I can't think of what her name was. In Star by Star, there was a female Jedi who had the ability in the Force to know where she was in the galaxy at any point. I was like, oh, this character's going to be cool. One and done. You know, and it's one of those things where it's like, I would just love to see them commit to characters that they've written and bring them back time and again. Reynar Thrall is probably the only one at this moment I can really feel that with. I mean, Zek, they were kind of doing it, and then Blood Oath got canceled. It's kind of like, I'll take what they gave me in Fate of the Jedi, but I want to see more of these stories. Where is iJedi 2? You know, give me a second Karan Horn book or something like that. I mean, we've got these stories out there, but they tend to be a 1, 2, or 3 book, and that's about it, and then they're referenced again in the big 3 story. I really want to see a commitment to these characters, not just, well, here's a book with some new characters in it, and it works, but you remember that book that we put out there 2 years ago about this complete new Jedi Jaden Kor, and then we had another one? Well, we're going to do a whole 4-book series all based off of his adventures. I'm ready for it.
Where's that Jedi? Where's that Jedi that could sense where she is in the galaxy at any given time? Oh, yeah, she's in the ground. No, I think you got a point. They need to build off of these characters. We're going to talk about Fate of the Jedi in an upcoming episode, and that's one of those instances where you had the opportunity to take pre-existing characters, especially ones who could have been extremely complex, like Tahiri, with all the stuff from New Jedi Order mixed with her experiences with Jason and everything else, and it doesn't seem like in a lot of cases the potential has a tendency to get filled or fulfilled. So you've got characters who were pre-existing, who could be better, could become something more, usually not being used that way, and not a lot of new major characters being introduced that are allowed to stick around. They are still very, very centered, probably from the marketing angle, as we got into in that episode, on the film and cartoon series characters. So, you know, we'll just have to see. It just seems like one of those things where there's got to be something that will grab a lot of people's attention with it, and they've done a great job doing that in some cases with the video games and the cartoon series and things like that. So maybe Star Wars can find some interesting way to blend these together. Maybe a marketing strategy like they do with the Legos. Legos got those little videos that they put online, you know, just to get you interested in Star Wars Legos. You know, give us a little, you know, 5-minute thing, or hey, make the fan challenge for the Fan Film Awards 1 year. Here's the general premise. Create a scene, and we'll use that to help market one of the books. Give us a chance to see characters who are brand new in action. Maybe get some of these Sith characters back when they were marketing Red Harvest. You know, have some zombie Sith out there. Have fans put together little videos where they're fighting each other, kind of like they had the fan marketing type stuff going on for Death Troopers. Give us a quick little 30-second, 2-minute video. Doesn't have to be all that special. You don't even have to name the characters unless, you know, the Wikipedia people really start going crazy. Give us the names. Give us the names. In a sense, sometimes it seems like the fan community is a lot like the House Un-American Activities Committee under McCarthy. You think that? But it's kind of one of those things where, you know, let the fans get involved. It saves you the cost on a production end for advertising. You can do it as a contest, tie it into the Atom Film stuff that's already being done. But the moment you start taking these characters that you're trying to get us interested in, and you put an actor behind the character, even for a moment, I think you really have a good chance of connecting with the audience. The Force Unleashed and some of these games with the recorded auditory dialogue, like what we've got with The Old Republic, being perfect case examples of it. But I guess we kind of belabored this point a bit, I suppose, haven't we?
Well, not. I mean, you know, you really bring a point. You know, you mentioned it before with Sam Witwer playing, you know, The Apprentice. But when you do have an actual persona to go with it, and one that everybody, you know, gets behind, you know, that definitely makes people have fan favorite characters. And in some cases, they don't even have to have read the book. They're just like, oh, it's Sam Witwer? Oh, I love everything he does. I gotta check it out. And so, I mean, I could see that too having some advantages to it. But another thing is the toy marketing too. I mean, you know, I would love to see more original EU characters popping up. I mean, as it is, they had a Kruk character out there. I didn't see it at my local store. Probably because they only made about 100 to every 500 of, I don't know, there's let's see, off the top of my head, let's say Darth Maul and a Qui-Gon Jinn right now is out there, and both of them are not that posable. You know, and yet you see these other ones that are just the clones that got the multi-posings and all this stuff, and it's like, I want some more EU characters that are posable and I can play with, you know? I mean, I want it. Quit holding out. There is a demand for EU stuff.
Don't worry, though. You will someday be able to find one of the characters, the action figures, whether it's on eBay or anywhere else, because if they're anything like the character, they will last forever.
Nice.
The next email comes in from Andrew Gilbertson, actually more of a Facebook post, but we're including it as feedback because it was in great detail here. This one is about the Jedi versus Sith conflicts and whether they undermine Return of the Jedi, playing into that episode we released a while back. Andrew is not particularly fond of the way that we presented it on the show, in the sense that he doesn't think that it's necessarily that we represented the case of those who argue that the conflicts undermine Return of the Jedi as clearly, I guess, as we should have. He says, "To be fair, not liking the cyclical Jedi slash Sithness is not a matter of not liking anything after Return of the Jedi. The whole Bantam era is relatively Sithless. It's only the post-New Jedi Order era and the numerous inserted in KOTOR slash TOR slash etc. eras that have led to this cyclical feeling. Well, okay, and Dark Empire, but that's an exception to the rule. So I think the opening argument is predicated on a false principle. That was not the other side's argument in the first place. Rather, it's the more recent KOTOR slash TOR slash Legacy slash Fate of the Jedi material, timeline spanning in Star Wars both far before and far after, and more recently published in real life, that has primarily contained this fault. Again, with the exception of Dark Empire, which tended to be a problem for specifically negating Vader's sacrifice thematically, more directly weakening the film saga and Return of the Jedi than bringing the Sith back in general, which seems to be a much lesser offense, only one that has been growing lately by increasing in quantity. Thus, choosing between post-Return of the Jedi stories and a non-cyclical Sith nature is a false dichotomy. And I think the issue is not so much cycles as narrative exhaustion. Perhaps, from a history teacher's perspective, the repetitiveness of history is realistic. But from a narrative perspective, it's worn out, exhausting, and seems to remove the relevance from any given battle, leaving nothing to invest in, because its resolution doesn't mean anything. And I think that's a perspective, again, looking at the false dichotomy above, that is stylistically and narratively based in general, not specific to a view of the saga in particular, that doesn't confine itself to solely those looking at Lucas's saga alone. Just because it can be justified, as it happens in history, does not mean that, from a fictional perspective, it makes good literature. And I'll remind you that those historical wars were not simply the same two sides of slight offshoots clashing over and over again. One led to the next. But they were diverse wars about diverse topics, and not the same two ideological groups clashing over and over and over. Heck, even the Crusades only went about, what, four rounds in quick succession? We do not see the US and Germany fighting war after war after war after war, nor do we see Christendom and Islam clashing, accounting for every major war. And when the series delves back 1,000 years and sets millenniums up as the timescales to consider, those many Sith wars do indeed seem way too close together, because we don't get intervening years focused the way we do between the Galactic Civil War and the post-New Jedi Order and Legacy stories. So even history doesn't truly back this pattern up. History is made of many diverse wars. No single conflict that I can think of daisy-chained into this many repetitions between the same two powers. So I think you need a do-over show. Actually, as a point of constructive criticism, on panel shows where neither of you agree with the point for the debate, it seems to me like you kind of tend to misrepresent the position of the other side because it's not one you're extremely familiar with. Either that, or I've just misunderstood the issues and am out of sync with the majority of fandom, which is definitely possible. Perhaps it would be helpful on such shows to have a guest representing the opposition to articulate a more accurate form of their position and avoid arguing against a straw man. I don't mean to quibble, and actually remove several points that seemed more argumentative because I don't mean to argue, just to point out what I think were some conceptual oversights in the construction of your case. I just don't feel like this show was an especially fair representation of the issue, much like the personal canon show, just kind of a discussion of a straw man point of view. Sorry if this comes off belligerent, insulting, arrogant, or possessed of any other Sith Lord traits."
That is a nice and big one, and well thought out, Andrew. In fact, you know, you're right in the aspect of bringing in extra people. That is something that we are going to be doing from time to time, and it sounds like we should have had you on for this one. You have a lot of very deep and valid points. You know, one thing, though, is I don't think we were trying really to debate it so much as explore it. And, you know, yeah, I don't think we were covering it 100% from all angles, but, you know, we kind of went different directions with it. You know, we kind of look at a question and see where it takes us, if you will. One thing, though, where you point out, you go, and I will remind you that those historical wars were not simply the same two sides of slight offshoots clashing over and over again, one led to the next. But, you know, when you say slight offshoots, with the Sith, what I've noticed is that that slight offshoot is what changes everything about them. The only thing that really makes the Sith throughout the timeline Sith is the fact that they're dark side users and they use that title. I mean, they're the different morals and the different reasonings behind what each group is doing changes as they evolve, in a sense. And so, I don't know. I mean, I definitely see where you're coming from, especially with the Bantam era. I mean, that one had hardly any Sith anything. I believe, like, we had a few Darksiders at best. And post-New Jedi Order, yeah, that is definitely when that direction and stuff started changing. I remember thinking Jason's character, when New Jedi Order came through, I thought we were going to get this whole new, it's not Sith, it's not Jedi, it's something new. And then darkness came, and it's like, okay, Jason's now a rogue Jedi. I don't know if that's still going to be the same thing. And then the next book series came out. It's like, okay, he's a Darksider. It's like, where are we going with this? Because that wasn't where I thought it was going originally. But it gets to that, you know, yeah, I could see what you're saying. How as it builds, it seems like that's the bigger problem, is that we keep seeing it now so much compared to the overall. I mean, you know, we mentioned in the beginning of this feedback episode how when you look at the timeline, it's easy to look at, but when you look at the publishing of the timeline, the story gets a little confusing. It's like, well, why weren't they mentioning Shmi in this book? Well, Shmi wasn't invented in that book. But yet the book that followed it, she was out. So they tried to fix that. You know, it's a very difficult topic, I guess I could say. And it does help, though, to get people that are, you know, passionate about each topic on, which is part of the reasons why, you know, we're going to have so many different hosts coming on for different topics. So I love your email. I love the well thought out. Totally, you know, keep it coming. I mean, we like the negative just as much as the positive, and that was a pretty positive one. I mean, really, it doesn't come off belligerent, insulting, or arrogant. Maybe possessive of a few Sith Lord traits, but that's about it.
You know, I think this kind of goes back to, you know, what was the question? What was the issue in question? If the issue in question was, do they go back and do the Jedi versus Sith stuff to death and do it too much? Then yeah, from a narrative perspective, absolutely. They constantly tend to go back to that same well. Although I would agree with Mark to the degree here that, yeah, they tend to give these groups slightly different traits. I mean, I'm reminded of the fact that, you know, to take that historical perspective, you're right, it's not the same people over and over again. It's not the U.S. versus Germany over and over again. Christianity versus Islam over and over again, like the Crusades. But the broader themes are still there. The absolutism or totalitarianism, fascism, communism, whatever, versus the side that's promoting more of an Enlightenment-style set of ideals. Those types of things. Or religious clashes, particularly dealing with schisms within a specific religion. I mean, the same themes repeat over and over again throughout human history. And the idea that you can't necessarily have an entire order completely wiped from existence and all their ideas disappear would mean that, yeah, some of those ideas are going to return, which is something that I mentioned in the show about how, you know, the Sith ideas are picked up and sort of evolve into these different groups. The Sith Empire may be gone for a while, but the Sith Empire itself isn't who Ulic and Exar Kun are working for. They take those traits, those teachings, and weave them in their own way, as do the new Sith that we get with Darth Ruin moving on from there and all that kind of stuff. But within history, there are patterns. But the question wasn't necessarily, you know, does the fact that it's showing these patterns in similar fashion in Star Wars with Jedi versus Sith, it wasn't, does that get old? Yeah, it does kind of get old. They always have to make sure they put another spin on it. If you're studying real history and you tend to only explore wars dealing with, say, Germany or its predecessors like Prussia, then yeah, that's going to get old after a while. You need to see a bigger picture and you need to notice those nuances, those differences in the groups, whether we're talking about new Sith versus Sith Empire versus the one Sith, or throughout history, you know, Holy Roman Empire, Germany under Hitler as the Third Reich, Germany under the Weimar Republic era and preceding that sort of thing. You know, there's all kinds of different ways of looking at nuances of history and nuances within Star Wars to see that at least they're not the exact same conflicts over and over again. But thematically, yes, they are the same general idea, light side versus dark side, Jedi versus Sith, happening over and over. The points that I would bring on that would be, one, they really probably in Star Wars should do a better job of, if there's going to be a new Sith-style order, maybe not calling them Sith. Maybe don't call them Lost Tribe of the Sith, the One Sith, the New Sith, the Classic Sith, the Sith Empire, etc., etc., etc. Maybe give us a different name. Even if it's a different name that's like a precursor to Sith, like we have Jedi going up into Jedi thanks to Dawn of the Jedi now. But yeah, it seems like the nature of the dark side-light side conflict is repetitive, but the naming tends to make it feel even more repetitive. So maybe thematically, stylistically, in the way they tell the story, maybe they should choose maybe some different terminology so that they vary the terms the same way that they're trying to vary the features of the different groups. But I would also say, as the other point, that that wasn't the question that was being asked. The question was, does the end of Return of the Jedi and the classic trilogy get undermined by this repetitive nature of Jedi versus Sith struggles? And I would say still that because logically you're not going to see the entire concept of Sith philosophy wiped from existence, and history does show that patterns repeat, and these different incarnations of the Sith are all growing organically from something else. They're not just popping up out of nowhere. For the most part, it makes logical sense for them to be there. I would still say it doesn't really undermine the end of Return of the Jedi. You can make the argument that, yes, Anakin's sacrifice doesn't wind up solving everything for the entire galaxy. But what does? What sacrifice, what event in actual history ever stops the story? Unless the Star Wars universe is redeemed by Anakin Skywalker's sacrifice, everybody dances with the Ewoks, and the next day, that galaxy blinks out of existence. There's going to be future struggles. There's going to be future darkness in the galaxy. If the idea is that if those dark philosophies ever rise again, it undermines the sacrifice of anyone who's ever died or anyone who's ever given themselves to somehow end the previous cycle of darkness, then you know what? Nobody's a hero ever. Nobody is ever able to actually have their sacrifice mean anything because there's always something more around the corner. Until history ends, you can't have it. And I think logically that doesn't really sit. So I can see the point of those who say that, yes, it undermines it because they want that to be the big climactic moment and they don't want to even consider the idea of seeing future darkness ahead, of seeing the Sith rise again, because they think of it in Lucas's terms of its Anakin saga. And for Anakin saga, if that's the way you look at it, yeah, it undermines things. But it's a very narrow point of view from which to see that undermining. And in the grand scheme of things, I just don't see how it logically works. From a storytelling perspective, if that was the question we were asking, I almost started speaking like people around me here in the South, axing. Let me ax you a question. Let me chop it up for you. Look, if that was a question that was being asked, then yes, I'm totally with you on the fact that they need to vary their storytelling style. But the question was, does it undermine? I do not think that it does. And I think in that case, we represented the sides fairly well, but certainly not the sides on the repetitive narrative issue.
Yeah, I think fandom as a whole is always going to be a little more lenient to the Sith and their roundabout nature in the earlier eras. I think the EU is going to take a hit from a lot of fans, especially like I call them the movie only fans, where, you know, they came back. Because to me, I think for most of those type of fans, it comes around the prophecy. You know, the whole story was about Anakin's prophecy. He was prophesied to destroy the Sith, and we see that in the films, and yet if the Sith came back, well, then it didn't work. I mean, granted, I can see why it has evolved the way it has, but for the fans that only see the prophecy as having to be fulfilled, I think that group of fans are going to be the ones that really feel that by them coming back post Return of the Jedi, it does damage Anakin's fate. But for me, as a fan of the EU as a whole, you know, I'm with Nathan. I don't see it being that big of an issue. I think it's really going to hinge down in how much you put on that prophecy. And, you know, again, when we get to Apocalypse, I've got a lot of feelings and a lot of ponders when it comes to this prophecy, now more than ever.
Oh, man, you know what this whole conversation just put in my head, and for the life of me, I can't figure out where this came from. It was some cartoon that I used to watch or something when I was younger. But it popped in my head, but the Sith came back the very next year. The Sith came back. We thought they were a goner, but I don't know what that is. It's something like the cat came back or something from when I was a little kid. Now it's going to be stuck in my head, and I hereby blame Andrew. No, I'm kidding. You know, Andrew's a good guy. We have had a chance to hang out a couple times at Con Carolinas. Andrew's a big factor in the Star Wars fan audio community out there, especially with his Marvel's audio drama. They've got a podcast now that's all about Doctor Who out there. So good guy, raises good points, always a good guy to debate these things with, even if we don't always necessarily agree. So thanks for writing, Andrew.
Yes, exactly. Thank you, Andrew. Our next email is from Jason B. He contacted us on Facebook, and he writes, there's been a whole lot of talk on various Star Wars podcasts about how someone could come into the EU now, considering the overwhelming amount of material one has to wade through. I thought I would outline my experience so that they would have an idea of how one individual approached it. I started reading the EU, and just as often, listening to audiobooks, in July of 2011. I have a 45-minute bus trip to and from work, so I have the time. Pretty randomly, I started with the Darkness trilogy. At the time, I knew that there were different eras, but this one was safely post-Return of the Jedi and a compact trilogy. Now, I gotta pause here. Jason, what do you mean by safely post-Return of the Jedi? And back to your email, good sir. I'm not going to give my opinion on everything that I read, but by the end of Dark Nest, I wanted to jump straight into Legacy of the Force. I will say that Denning, and most Star Wars writers by far, do an amazing job of seamlessly touching back to earlier storylines and character experiences, and give you just enough info to understand why what's currently happening is important to the story of the character. In terms of Legacy, I did feel like I was missing some of the depth to the tragedy that was supposed to be happening with Jason's turn to the dark side. When I finished Legacy and listened to a number of podcasts discussing it, which were then 2 years old, I did agree that Darth Cadus' run was way too short, and it would have been great to see him become a real menace to the galaxy. What was there, however, I thought was well done. A final comment, if I can jump ahead for a moment, is that when I read Fate of the Jedi and even some Phantom Menace / Jedi Quest, the gravity of the actions Jason took and his breaking of the Jedi prescribed boundaries of Force use that he made during his turn really came home to me. I then immediately went into Fate of the Jedi, but I won't get into it as it's still relatively fresh for some, but I enjoyed it. Probably a lot more than some of those with a lot of the EU experience. Catching up with the publishing schedule of Fate of the Jedi gave me gaps to go back and read other novels, the Thrawn trilogy. Because of attention, the re-release of Heir to the Empire got, Star Wars from the Adventures of Luke Skywalker, because I got to read Splinter of the Mind's Eye, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, because it had been bashed so hard in various podcasts, good reason, and Vector Prime, to start getting into the New Jedi Order, but I hadn't progressed beyond the first book. What I find interesting is that in reality there is often some expectation that you've read previously published books, even if the current book you're reading is set earlier chronologically. Case in point, Darth Plagueis. Given the hype of this release and the subject matter, I read Darth Plagueis right away, with the Phantom Menace movie my only info about that time. The hype is deserved. It definitely is one of the top three EU books that I have read. But reading it first and then Cloak of Deception and then Phantom Menace novelization was a real letdown. Oh man, I can bet. It is superior in writing quality and content, but its scope is so broad that it renders Cloak useless. So if you haven't read these three yet, I would suggest Cloak of Darkness, Phantom Menace, and then top it off with Darth Plagueis. Right now I'm marching my way through the prequel era because I wanted to get to Labyrinth of Evil, the Revenge of the Sith novelization, and Dark Lord, Rise of Darth Vader. Because Return of the Sith novelization were rated the greatest piece in the Star Wars EU. Hey, it is up there, man. It is up there. So far, I finished Rogue Planet, and I'm halfway through the Jedi Quest series, the first young adult novels I've read. The young adult novels aren't half bad, actually, and feature plenty of action. Having read Approaching Storm already, I'm thinking that there is still an amazing adult novel lurking in that time where Anakin was a young apprentice. In terms of other eras, I'm ignoring the Old Republic stuff right now because I simply wouldn't be able to keep up, nor do I watch the Clone Wars series, as my sons are too little right now, so I figure I can enjoy it together later. And I'm probably going to skip the Clone Wars EU stuff so I can get into the Dark Lord trilogy faster. After that, who knows? I haven't mentioned comics because they aren't really my favorite medium for storytelling. I find myself just reading the captions and missing the story being told through the art. That's funny, because I do the same thing on occasion. I have to go back and reread it. But I am picking up the Dark Horse digital stuff. Dark Empire, Crimson Empire, as it goes on sale, and I'm enjoying it, but I'm having a hard time melding the two, books and comics, into a single cohesiveness. Finally, I'm really enjoying Star Wars EU podcasts. I subscribe to 7 right now, and they have really helped me decide what I want to read next. I would encourage everyone to listen to them. It's a great community, and it's lots of fun. I don't find them really spoilerish either. I mean, if you know the 6 movies, and you know the basic character arcs, and that Obi-Wan dies in episode 4, so he's not going to die beforehand. And then he goes ahead and gives us a nice big list of everything he's read. And it is quite impressive. You know, Nathan, you know, I don't know if there's much more I can say aside from thanks for writing in. You know, we really appreciate it.
I think it gives a good perspective on the way that this reading needs to be approached. He points out one big thing about how some of these do assume that you have prior knowledge. And after we had that episode, I've heard that from a couple of different people about how basically, you know, Star Wars novels, they are sometimes quite guilty of basically assuming some kind of prior knowledge that's there or referencing something that they assume you might know about or know where to find information about. But for someone who's new, you come in and yeah, sometimes it's hard to really be able to follow what's going on. That's not to say that we're talking about those little nuances, the little continuity references, the Lucinopedia type stuff like we mentioned for Darth Plagueis, but sometimes just something like what you've mentioned before about reading the Jedi Academy trilogy and then referencing back to Dark Empire. And, you know, who knows where that was? You know, at the time, people were asking the question, where did Luke fall to the dark side, as you mentioned earlier? And that same kind of thing still happens now, quite often. You know, you're reading one book and you're like, well, when did this happen? And you have to actually go research it to find it, where they don't tend to give enough hints as to where you might be able to find it. I don't know how you easily make up for that, unless your story is completely self-contained for the most part, like we got with, say, Scourge, or by giving footnotes in every single novel, because there are just so stinking many of them out there and such a huge continuity at this point. But it's definitely something that sometimes the writers need to be a little bit more conscious of as they're working on it. And I would say, though, that since he did mention the fact that he read, what was it, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, I guess it was, because it was bashed so often, I suppose that next on the list should be, in terms of comics, Dark Times and Tales from the Mos Eisley Cantina. Have fun with those. Dark Times is coming back for another storyline now that Out of the Wilderness is over with. That falls under the heading for me of, oh God, why? But the last episode, the last issue, episode whatever, the last issue of Out of the Wilderness was decent enough. You know, would have been nice if the whole series was like that. So we'll see how Dark Times goes forward. But yeah, it is an interesting approach to go with the stuff that's been heard as bashed, just to kind of say, you know, this is so bad, I gotta see it. You know, it's so bad, it's good. It's like somebody gives you a horrible movie review and you're like, that can't be that bad. I've got to watch this thing. I can't tell you how many movies I used to rent back when our local video store had five movies for 5 days for $5, where it was just, this can't be that bad. And then I
watched it. That's like everybody that goes in and does the holiday special is that way. They're just like, it can't be that bad. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, then you finish it up, you're like, yes, yes it is. But of course, then you have to share it with someone else because you can't be the last person to experience the horror. So you turn around and you're like, hey, have you seen the holiday special? You know, I just saw the holiday special. It did this. And you get them just enough information to want to see it, and you pass it on. It's kind of like the holiday special is like that video in The Ring, right? You know, you got to pass it on because somebody's going to be killed by the little creepy girl, or I guess in this case, the little creepy, sopping wet, matted hair Wookiee that's climbing out of the well.
Now, Jason, you know, you also mentioned about how it's hard to go from the comics to the books and get the cohesiveness. I too have a problem with that. I mean, I'm not as in depth when it comes to my timeline as Nathan is. And so I'm always like, I think it goes here. And I kind of just slap my comics together. I try to keep them in a chronological order. But when it comes to the two, my bookshelf and my comic boxes, I got to go to the Wikipedia to find out where the timeline really kind of line up. And even then I'm like bouncing back and forth. Okay, I think, all right, yep, okay, uh-huh. And it's just one of those things like, you know, the comics, there's so many out there. And, you know, I had the same, you know, like I mentioned, you read the pictures only, or you're only reading the words. I think I'll read them almost three times. Like when I very first get them, I kind of flip through them and I'm just looking at the pictures. And then I go back through it and then I read it, but I'm not really paying attention. And then I go back a third time and I get the whole experience. And then I'm like, okay, now how does this fit with the books? And that is just a whole nother conundrum. You know, it's just one of those things that it can be mind boggling. But for people getting into the EU, you know, and I walk people through with this on our Facebook page. I mean, it really comes down to what you like. I mean, you know, if you're more into the Wookiees and stuff, then there are certain books that are going to appeal to you. If you like Mandalorians, there's certain books that are going to appeal to you. If you cannot stand the Jedi, there are certain books that you're not going to want to read. But it is an interesting approach, like Nathan said, to go with ones that you really have heard have been bashed upon. And that, I got to say, good luck with the Bounty Hunter trilogy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, Dark Times, Tales from Mos Eisley, not Tales from the Mos Eisley Cantina, which is maybe how I said it earlier. I can't remember how I said it earlier. But Tales from Mos Eisley, that one shot out there. Beware, beware. But apparently, you know, have fun with that. But, yeah, the way that the comics and novels are integrated or not integrated at times, as the case may be, that is something I think would be confusing in a lot of cases, because you hear about how the EU is so interconnected, and the novels tend to be interconnected. The comics, a lot of times, not always, but the comics tend to be somewhat interconnected, and yet there really isn't a lot of times where you absolutely need one for the other. I mean, really, the Clone Wars era is about the only era where you really need to be able to read the novels and the comics to get the whole picture. A lot of times it's just, where do we slip this story in? Well, oh, Crimson Empire 3, Empire Lost. Let's slip it in right here. Yeah, that's an okay place. The characters have a chance to go to the bathroom here, so let's take away that chance, and, you know, here's the new story. A lot of times, fortunately, you don't have to be a fan of both media to be able to enjoy it in one medium or the other. You know, it's something that can be experienced in an either-or fashion or in a bigger picture perspective. So, which I guess either means that they're really good at making sure that you're not required to jump between the two, or it means that they don't do a good enough job, perhaps, of integrating the two. I guess it depends on what you want out of your stories. And actually, jumping off of something that Mark just mentioned when responding to Jason, we have another Jason who has emailed us. Jason, I believe it's Latrell, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, who asked something similar as far as where to start in the novels. He says, "Hey guys, love the show. I've been collecting the Star Wars novels for many years, but for some reason never read any of them. Well, this year I decided to jump in. I started with Shadowhunter, then moved to Darth Plagueis, and now have started Tales of the Bounty Hunters. I know, kind of random. I suppose I should try to pick out some type of order to read the novels, but that seems like an overwhelming task. Since you two seem to have a really good handle on the novels, how do you think I should proceed? Continue on my whims, or decide on an order and follow through? I love your advice. Best regards, Jason Latrell." Honestly, Jason, the way that I would probably approach it is kind of what Mark said about, you know, you need to focus on whatever it is you find most interesting. So, you know, if there's something, let's say you find the Commandos, the Republic Commandos, particularly intriguing to you because you like the idea of the clone troopers and you want to see where that goes. In that case, you can find sort of their story, their through line within the EU, and check out just those stories, Republic Commando, Order 66, Imperial Commando, that sort of thing. Maybe you're someone who is more interested in seeing how the new Jedi Order develops. In that case, you know, maybe pick up with, say, if you haven't read the Thrawn Trilogy, check out the Thrawn Trilogy as a starting point, but then pick up, oh, Jedi Academy Trilogy, and then move forward from there until you get to the New Jedi Order, then Legacy of the Force, because they each have these leap and bound type of developments for the Jedi Order. It really, really depends. You may be finding yourself in dangerous territory, though, if you try to go with the continuing on the whims, because what if you pick up a book that sort of assumes that you understand something else that has happened and you've never heard of it? For instance, you wouldn't necessarily want to pick up in the middle of a series, or even if you're picking up with book one, I'm not sure you'd want to pick up, say, Fate of the Jedi book one, Outcast, without having previously read Legacy of the Force. So it really, really is dependent on where you intend to start, where those whims are going to take you. But of course, even if you were to go with something that is requiring some background knowledge, the only really two things you got to look out for is, yes, it may require some background knowledge, so you may have to do some research. One way you could do that is perhaps through the New Essential Chronology, the Star Wars Timeline Gold. New Essential Chronology, by the way, was recently referenced, or not recently, I saw it recently, referenced a few years ago by Spencer Reed on Criminal Minds, which was apparently something that Dan Wallace and Kevin J. Anderson had not seen yet. So when I shared that on Facebook, they were like, hey, holy crap, you know, we're actually in Criminal Minds. Sadly, though, another of the character, Morgan, walks away and says, you know, she's trying to get back 5 minutes of his life about that conversation from that. So I'm like, what was that all about? But there's that. I mean, there's the need for research, possibly. Plus, you also got to kind of just assume as you go into it that there's going to be a lot of stuff that's going to be spoiled for you. I mean, if you don't want to know how Legacy of the Force ends, then any reference to what is going on with Jason or with the legacy of Jason or anything like that in Fate of the Jedi is going to totally wind up leaving you with the ending of Legacy of the Force spoiled on you. Then again, if you're listening to podcasts like this one, where we talk about things from years ago without spoiler warnings and only stick the spoiler warnings on the new stuff, I gotta assume that that's probably not as much of an issue for you. You probably already have sort of resigned yourself to or accepted the idea that there's gonna be stuff that's spoiled. You just want to see how it plays out. And if that's the case, then no worries. Just make sure you got, you know, Wikipedia or something, or the timeline or New Essential Chronology handy in case you got to go back and quickly check on a reference with maybe referring to something you haven't heard of, and, you know, have at it. Pick whatever. So it really, really depends. It would help us to know, and maybe you can mention this and we can go into this in another feedback episode sometime and give you more specific advice. It would help to know what those whims are, or what where you would start that order. You said, should I continue on my whims or decide on an order and follow through? Where would you want to start that order, and what are the whims you have that are pushing you in a certain direction? If we knew that, we could probably better advise.
Yeah, and that's a perfect example of what Facebook is for. It's our tool to interact with you. For me, you know, the chronology, the essential chronology and the new essential chronology were great. You know, it gives you a great basic overall view of what's going on in the universe. You have a general idea of what pretty much each story is going to be without being spoiled completely. And for me, that was really, that's what gave me my continue on my whims or decide in order kind of direction. And I think when I look at it, when I recommend stories to people, they're more character-driven recommendations. Like, you know, one of my favorite characters is Coran Horn. So I would suggest, you know, you read the X-Wing series and get an idea of who he is, and then go into the Jedi Academy series. And a lot of people think I'm crazy for this, but I always suggest Jedi Academy and then read I, Jedi, because I think you get more out of I, Jedi if you know what happened in the other series. And, you know, so you can kind of follow Coran Horn's arc through X-Wing into I, Jedi and get a really cool story there. Jacen Solo is another character that, you know, a lot of people love him or hate him. And I've talked to my wife about this a lot when the New Jedi Order and the later book series were coming out. I really liked Jason's story because I had read the junior books. And so I'd kind of followed him from his two-year-old moment in the Jedi Academy series all the way up to where we see him and eventually fall. And I was just, you know, to me, because I'd read that stuff, his character, it was more painful. It was like, oh, you know, some people call it derailment. To me, it was kind of like more of a sacrifice of what he was and what they were doing with him because of, you know, you'd seen where he had gone all along, and it was just like, oh, man, why is he doing it? And there were so many people that were like, oh, you know, it's just not – he's learned that lesson. He wouldn't do it. And I think about life, and life isn't like that. People will go and they'll make a mistake, and they will try to fix it, and they'll like – you know, a week or two, a month goes by, a year goes by, they find they're making that same mistake, they got to fix it again, and that kind of thing. And so for Jason's story, that was one of those kind of stories, and it's like, for me, if you want to get the most out of a story like that, you're going to want to take the time and read it. Is it necessary? No, but I do think you will get more out of it. And so in that regard, it kind of comes down to, I wouldn't just pick and choose. I would kind of try to commit to a couple stories or an era at a time, if you will. You know, maybe go with the older stuff. And that was the direction I went because I got into it late 90s, beginning of the 2000 era. And there was books out there that I was catching up on. So I was trying to read all those first so I could get into the other ones because I knew that there were retcons that had came and that they weren't going to quite line up. And so that was always been one of those things, like for the newer readers, I was curious as to how they handle those retcons when they're like, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? This whole section of the book doesn't make sense. And so that's one of those things, too, that you got to keep in mind when you're going forward. So it's definitely one of those things where we need to kind of know where you want to go to help point you. I mean, there's some great stories out there, and there's some great train wrecks.
Yeah, and I mean, I could totally understand how you would go into something and a whole section of a book would not make sense. I mean, I remember that part in Fate of the Jedi where and Legacy of the Force. There were a couple of parts in there where they go back and they're talking about Tahiri and they're referencing her time being essentially a half-transformed into a Yuuzhan Vong. Oh, wait. Those didn't ever show up in those, did they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, good questions. Just not really entirely sure where to point you. But if you know anybody who you don't want to talk Star Wars with and you're tired of them and you want to get them to get off your back and they're asking you all the time, hey, where should I start? Best thing to do, recommend the Crystal Star. Tell them it's the best and it's all downhill from there. You'll never have to worry about them again.
Oh, that's priceless. Priceless information and valuable tips brought to you by Nathan P. Butler.
And on that note, we have sucked all the energy out of the conversation. Actually, we just have emptied the mailbox. But like Woru the Anti-Force being, I think we're good to go here. finally. lots of information, lots of different emails that were very evocative this time around. Be sure that you get in contact with us. You can catch us on Facebook, facebook.com/SWBeyondFilms. You can catch us on Twitter, @SWBeyondFilms. Those two basically the same. You can email us, this one's different, beyondthefilms@StarWarsFanWorks.com. You can also, of course, just hop up on StarWarsReport.com, and any of our blog posts that have the initial release of an episode, you can leave comments for. So you can even just go straight on there and put those in there. But however you do it, we'd love to hear from you, and we do appreciate all the different reviews and such over on iTunes and Zoom Marketplace and such. So be sure, you know, interact with us, and maybe you'll find some of the things that you have sent out to us showing up here on the show for further discussion.
So once again, this has been Mark Herleman.
And Nathan Butler.
Okay, all right. Yes, yes, Whistler's been here broadcasting this episode for your listening entertainment. And once again, thanks, and may the Force be with you.
And don't quote him the odds. You can quote it to me anytime you want. I'm just not going to listen to you. What was Whistler doing that whole time? Was he in the process of trying to reveal more secret facts about, you know, like Padme or something in the background? All of a sudden, there's more stuff hidden inside the astromech?
I don't know. I mean, he gets creepy like that. It's like all of a sudden he's like peering around the thing. There was an R2 video, in fact. Did you see that one where the whole, they made it like a horror movie, like R2 was killing everybody?
No, but I could see that happening now that they did Beneath the Dome. You know, the star goes crazy. Although you know what? It's too bad we're out of time for the episode, because I bet you Whistler could figure out the truth behind the whole Will to Live thing. The recordings must be there somewhere.
Indeed.